This is London Calling.
Hi, I'm Graham Mack, and my guest is retired Air Force Colonel and astronaut Terry Virts. I asked him, what was the scariest thing he did when he was flying in space?
The biggest fear was cutting my crewmate's hair. Samantha is an Italian lady, and I flew with her, and she's the most famous Italian woman in the world. And they do these polls, and she's like number one. And so before we went into space, she wouldn't let me fly until I went to her hairdresser with her and learned how to do a proper lady's haircut. And so it's one of the things I never thought I'd do as a fighter pilot, but I learned the whole thing, how to hold the scissors, how to put the clips in. You know, for my hair, I just take the clippers, set it on number two, and you know, my hair is cut. But for hers, it was like this long process. And it was nerve-wracking, because if I screw that up, there's 30 million angry Italian mothers, right? And so I didn't want to be that guy.
Well, it's Christmas shopping season, and that means it's difficult to find a parking space near the shops. And the traffic wardens are out in force. They hunt in packs, giving tickets to unsuspecting motorists. And Lynn, you've got a parking story.
You're going to absolutely love this one. This is true, definitely true. My mum was a traffic warden.
Right.
And when my eldest girl, who's now 36, was when she was about four or five, I had to go to the shops to get some bits from our local co-op in Chesham. And I parked with her outside the shop. She was in the car, locked her in, charged in, got the bits I needed. Literally, I was only no more than 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Got back to the car, and she used to call my mum, Mama. She never called her grandma.
Right.
And she said, Mum, Mama came and put that thing on the windscreen of the car.
No. No.
Yes. My own mother gave me a ticket.
Did she know it was your car?
My daughter was in, her granddaughter was in the back of the car. So when I got home, I rang her and said, Mum, what are you doing giving me a ticket? She said, you were parked illegally. You are not my daughter when you're on the road with a car. And if I had left you out, all the other cars that had also got tickets would have complained.
I think your mum's taking the job too seriously.
Yeah, so do I. I could not, but I had to laugh.
Well, yeah,
because
but now,
I could,
you know,
not believe my own mum would give me a ticket.
I give traffic wardens a hard time, but this is proof right here, isn't it? They deserve everything they get.
But I should not have been there. She was right. I should not have been there.
I know, Lynn, but come on, and their granddaughter's in the back of the car.
Her answer to that was, why did you leave Claire in the car in the first place? Because I had to go and get mushrooms for her for breakfast.
If you say Jesus backwards, it sounds like sausage. But that doesn't mean you can depict the Saviour as a sausage in a nativity scene. Greggs the Bakers has apologised after replacing baby Jesus with a sausage roll in a nativity scene to promote their advent calendar. A right-wing pressure group called the Freedom Association isn't happy. Simon Richards, who's their chief executive, described the image as sick. He also said, we all know that they would never dare insult other religions. To me, it all seems a bit strange for an organisation called the Freedom Association to want to censor a business whose advertising campaign hasn't broken any laws or rules of advertising standards. If you're offended by what Greggs have done, you're free not to spend any of your money there. That's freedom. I agree with Simon Richards when he says, we all know that they would never dare insult other religions. But isn't that a good thing? Doesn't it show that most Christians have a sense of humour and wouldn't attack a Greg shop like radical factions of other faiths might? I really don't see what all the fuss is about. A lot of Christians are told that the communion wafer literally is the flesh of Christ. Well, if he can be a wafer, Why can't he be a sausage roll? In a few weeks' time, I'm going to Uganda in Africa, so I've had to have shots, or as we call them in Britain, jabs. It's not been pleasant. Daphne's on the phone.
Are you all right, are you?
Well, I'm okay. I've got the, you know, you don't want to hear about my problems. I've got jabs in both arms yesterday. I've still got more to come. Yeah.
I thought you could go to the doctors for it.
Well, that was all typhoid, and also I've still got to do yellow fever, and I've got to take malaria tablets. I'm going to Uganda.
Yeah, you're going away, aren't you?
Yeah, not till February, though.
You're having it early then, aren't you?
Well, I want to get it done.
Yeah, over and done with.
I don't want to get anything. She said to me, when you go there, will you be going outside much? I said, I will be arriving at a hotel and I will not be leaving the hotel. I don't like the great outdoors anyway, but to be outdoors on the equator, I don't think so.
And it'd be too hot, wouldn't it?
Way too hot.
Yeah, what are you going there for then?
I'm speaking at a radio conference. I'm telling radio people in Africa how to be more like me.
Oh, right. Oh, dear.
Because I've always said what we need on the radio is more people like me. I'm the only one that says it, but that's why I'm going there.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Well, I hope they'll like it.
I hope they will, yeah. I hope they understand it.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if there's a translator going to translate what I say, because they have their own language, don't they?
Yeah, they do. Well, they have Swahili, don't they?
I don't know what they have. Well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'm going to find out what is the most difficult tongue twister in their language, and I'm going to say it in English to make the translator have to say it. Politicians want to control you and take away your freedom. In some places, they're taking that to extremes, you know, places like North Korea. But it's happening in Europe too. In Helsinki, Finland, they're experimenting with a thing called universal basic income. It'll be enough to live on, much higher than a pension or unemployment benefit, and everyone gets the same government handout. It won't be means-tested. The disabled will get the same as the able-bodied. Pensioners will get the same as young people who are working. The difference between adults and children is that adults are not dependent on their parents. Universal basic income turns everyone into dependent children and makes the government your parent. The government is a group of politicians. Politicians are driven by a hunger for power. The ones that make it to the top are the ones that are hungriest for that power. And the way they satisfy that appetite for power is through control. When the government controls your income, they have total control over you. If you don't conform, they can threaten to cut you off. If an employer treats you like a child, you've got the freedom to quit and go and work for someone else. No one wants their income to be dependent on a controlling parent. Under the system of universal basic income, you can work as well and earn money on top without losing your government handout. What kind of workforce will that produce? One of the things that motivates employees is the fear of losing their job and therefore their only source of income. Finland's just the start of this. Fife Council in Scotland is planning its own basic income trial. They want to apply it to an entire town, giving up to £7,000 to everyone. That's almost $10,000. And you'll get it no matter your age or your employment status. The way you know that universal basic income is a bad idea is that it's attracted praise from the political left and right. When does that ever happen? You see, both sides can see how much power it would give them through total control of an electorate, and how easy it would be to win an election just by promising to raise the level of universal basic income. They already know how to buy votes from people who always turn out to vote. Pensioners. That's why in Britain, pensioners get free TV licenses, a winter heating allowance, even if they live in Spain, and a triple lock on their pensions that guarantees they get an increase every year by a minimum of 2.5%, or the rate of inflation, or average earnings growth, whichever is largest. Governments have a duty of care and must look after the vulnerable in our society. That's what state handouts are for. If you give handouts to everyone, then everyone becomes vulnerable. If you think universal credit is a good idea, you're either hopelessly utopian, naive, or a politician. It's the biggest risk to our freedom since the threat of Nazi occupation. The British government have announced that we're going to have driverless cars on our roads by the year 2021. What do you think of this news, Barry?
I don't think it's going to work.
You don't think it's going to work? Oh, they'll get the hang of it eventually, won't they?
The drivers at the moment don't, so...
Well, yeah, but the drivers aren't computers. The drivers are human error. They're humans. Take the humans out. You take the error out, don't you?
That is very true.
More people are killed on the roads of the world every year than are killed in all the wars. It's like, if you want to save lives, don't campaign for peace. Campaign for driverless cars. You'll save more lives. That's stunning, isn't it? More people are killed on the roads of the world than terrorism, wars. There'll be no pedestrian deaths. There'll be no cyclists getting killed if we have driverless cars. We'll have a lot more people alive. We'll have to do a lot more, contraception. That's going to be the big bonus. Driverless cars. It's a game-changing technology. I mean, everything will change. You know, all those people who drive for a living will have to find something else to do. We're going to be overpopulated. We're going to need loads more roads because no one's going to get the train when a driverless car will be so much cheaper, especially if it's run on electricity, and it'll be so much easier than, we won't need buses because you'll just call. I mean, driverless, once they're driverless, you won't even need to own a car. You'll just go on the app on your phone. A car will show up like Uber with no driver. You'll get in. It'll take you where you want to go. And then you'll get out. You won't even need to own a car. Everything will change. We don't know what will happen to the motor industry, to car dealers. It's just going to be game changing. Doesn't that blow your mind, Barry? Honestly, some people are hard to impress. Same-sex marriage may soon be legal in Australia. Australians voted to legalise same-sex marriage in a national survey. 61.6% of voters said yes to change the law. 38.4% were opposed. That seems high to me. I lived in Australia for a long time. I remember it being a very tolerant society. In fact, the gay Mardi Gras in Sydney was one of the main events of the year. It was like that and New Year's Eve. So I don't understand that almost 40% of those who voted were against a change in the law. This morning, I watched an interview on Sky News with a lady who campaigned against gay marriage. She said she was opposed because she was a Christian. I mean, the Bible is homophobic. If you were to write or say now some of the stuff that was written in the Bible, you would clearly be accused of being homophobic. Leviticus 20:13, it says, and here's a quote, "If a man lies with a male as with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood is upon them." Now, not many modern Christians want to put gay people to death. They've taken a more secular view on homosexuality. In fact, they've been doing that for a while. They've taken a more secular view on a lot of other things in the Bible. For instance, Numbers 15, 32 to 36 in the King James Version, it's pretty strict when it comes to the penalty for violating the Sabbath. Here's what it has to say. Now, while the children of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man gathering sticks on the Sabbath, and those who found him gathering sticks brought him to Moses and Aaron, and to all the congregation. They put him under guard, because it had not been explained what should be done to him. Then the Lord said to Moses, "The man must surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp." So as the Lord commanded Moses, all the congregation brought him outside the camp and stoned him with stones, and he died. So, it turns out, according to the Bible, homosexuality, punishable by death, it's just as bad as gathering sticks on the Sabbath. This was this lady's argument, though, for not having same-sex marriage. This lady was saying in the interview that allowing gay people to marry restricted her religious freedom. I don't get that. I don't get how, if gay people can marry, how she is less free. I don't see it's made any difference to my life or anybody's lives around me who are not a gay couple. But it's not made anybody less free, has it? Which brings us to the tolerance paradox. That's the tolerance of a religious dogma that restricts other people's freedom. Because there are more extreme examples of this. For instance, Saudi Arabia, they throw gay people off buildings. But we don't interfere with that, because that's their religious belief. That's their religious freedom. What about the freedom of the person being thrown off the building? It's the tolerance paradox. And a ban on gay marriage restricts the freedom of gay couples. It stops them enjoying the benefits in law that come with a marriage license. These are things that can safeguard their families and protect them. Some of the protections and obligations of marriage which are denied to gay couples include hospital visitations, child custody, adoption, parenting rights, medical decision-making power, automatic inheritance, standing to sue for wrongful death of a spouse, divorce protections, spousal and child support, access to family insurance policies, exemption from property tax upon death of a spouse, immunity from being forced to testify against one's spouse, domestic violence protections, and loads more. They don't get any of those that people get who are heterosexual couples as a right in law. If gay marriage is illegal, where it is in Australia, the gay couples don't get any of those protections. And I come back to it. How exactly are Christians' rights and freedoms affected if gay people are allowed to marry? In our secular society, you are free to believe in and worship any god you like. And that freedom exists because we have secular, not religious, values. In most religions, people who don't believe that particular religion are shunned. In some cases, it ends in death. People are put to death for being infidels or non-believers. And then there's religious wars. But in secular societies, you are free. You are more free in a non-religious society to be religious than you are in a religious society. And that freedom to follow a faith and worship however you like is not affected at all when a gay couple gets married. What really would affect the freedom of all of us would be if we were all forced to conform to rules set down in a book that was written thousands of years ago by people who thought the world was flat and didn't know where the sun went at night. We'll be right back. Well, it's that time of year again, Christmas shopping season. Fraught with danger. How do you go, Mick?
I bought my wife a coffee machine.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what else to buy. I bought this coffee machine and I give it to her. And she says to me, "Why did you buy me this for?" And I said, "I thought you might like it." And she said, "I've been hinting for ages what I wanted. You obviously haven't taken the hint." So she goes, "Can you take it back and get the money?" So I took it back and got the money for it. So the next birthday, I thought, I'm not going to do it again. So I just put 200 quid in a card, she opened the card up and she went to me, "Oh, you give me money?" I said, "Yeah, you can buy what you want then." She went, "Well, there's no fault in that, is there?" And I thought, what do you do? You know what I mean? You can't do anything right, can you?
So what are you planning to get her this year, Mick?
Do you know what? I'm completely confused. You don't know what to buy for the best, do you?
Have you noticed any hints coming your way? Anything at all?
No, she hasn't hinted at all saying that.
All right. If anyone's got any idea, well, what's she into?
Do you know what? I've been married nearly 30 years and I don't really know. That's quite sad, isn't it?
Mick, I don't think I can help you.
I think anybody can help me, to be honest with you.
Bad news if you've ever fancied riding a bike naked through Britain. The British government has announced it wants to put driverless cars on our roads by 2021. About 100 cyclists are killed on the roads of Great Britain every year, and more than 3,000 are seriously injured. When all cars are driverless, no cyclists will be killed or injured on our roads. The technology won't let a driverless car collide with a pushbike. But no cycling organisation has ever campaigned for driverless cars, even though it's the only way to make cycling on the road safe. They've been busy campaigning for cycle paths and for drivers to be more aware of cyclists, and they've organised naked bike rides where hundreds of people of all shapes, sizes and ages take off their clothes and ride around as a protest against how vulnerable they are. If they'd put as much effort into campaigning for driverless cars over the last 20 years, we might have driverless cars by now, and more cyclists would still be alive. If we had non-polluting solar-powered driverless cars, why would anyone even ride a bike? That'd be great, because there'd be no more naked bike rides, and we wouldn't have to see all those nipples, racks, cogs, and other parts that make up bicycles. Or naked people's saddles. In 1997, in the German city of Frankfurt, a man reported his car stolen to the police. 20 years later, the authorities in the city have tracked down the missing car, only to discover that the man who owned it had just forgotten where he parked it. And he thought it was stolen. The vehicle's been found in a garage in an old industrial building that's due to be demolished. It was a car park when he parked there. But it isn't now. And the car's useless now. 20 years just sitting there rotting away. What's your lost and found story, Cherie?
Someone I know very, very well, some time ago, 15 or so years ago, came in from work, self-employed, a considerable amount of money in an envelope,
okay.
Like you did.
Yeah.
I think what happened, got distracted when he got in, so he's hidden it, but can't remember where he's hidden it.
Right.
So he then spent the whole weekend with the rest of the family, trying to find that upside down house. Towards the end of the weekend, I think they decided it's lost outside of the property, because we just can't find it. There's nowhere else for it to be.
Yeah.
So they just wrote it off.
Yeah.
Then, probably 10 years later.
10 years later, yeah.
10 years later, having a sort out around the house and doing some refurbishment and getting rid of some old furniture to a charity shop.
Yeah.
Charity guys come in, And as they take away two sofas, take the cushions off and spin it over to put it in the van, and they hear a thump.
Yeah.
Pull the bottom off, and it's in an envelope in the bottom of the sofa.
It had gone down, it literally gone down the back of the sofa.
Yeah, I think maybe it just maybe got squished behind a cushion, or maybe it was a quick hide, like you do, and it just got squished and forgotten about and done in a panic or whatever. But yeah, and we're talking a few thousand.
Clearly, this proves the existence of the fourth dimension.
Absolutely.
That sofa was a portal into another universe.
But can you imagine?
It went through there and then it came back.
Yeah, if they hadn't heard it and it had got sold in the charity shop.
Oh, what a bonus that would have been for somebody.
Yeah, win-win.
Yeah.
Brexit and the election of Donald Trump have a lot in common. They came straight after each other, and people voted for basically the same thing. They wanted their country back. To be more accurate, they wanted to feel as if they had their country back. I can't speak for America, but in Britain, Brexiteers may now feel like they're going to get their country back. But so far, nothing about Brexit has been good. And a year and a half after our referendum, we're still a long way from leaving the EU. Jobs have already been lost. This week, it was announced that the European Banking Authority and the European Medicines Agency are moving from London to mainland Europe, with the loss of around 1,000 jobs. A lot of people voted for Brexit because they thought foreigners were taking British jobs. Well, it might have felt like that, but it wasn't true. At the time of record immigration, we also had the lowest unemployment figures in decades. So foreigners were not taking British jobs. The irony is that now, because of Brexit, they are. If you think Brexit is a good idea, you haven't done the math. The Prime Minister, Theresa May, is right now ready to offer £40 billion to the EU as a payment for letting us get out. Now, during the referendum campaign, pro-leave politicians, including Boris Johnson, were pictured in front of a big red bus with a banner on it that said, "We send the EU £350 million a week. Let's fund our NHS instead." The NHS is the National Health Service, the cradle-to-grave socialised medicine we have here. It was classic fake news. Those figures don't add up. The net amount the EU gets from us is nowhere near that much. Now, assuming the EU accept our offer of £40 billion and we manage to break that down into, let's say, £350 million a week, on top of the supposed £350 million we pay them every week anyway, it would take more than 2 years to pay off that full amount of £40 billion. I'm sorry, but how exactly does that give us our country back? Now, the big difference between the election of President Trump and the vote for Brexit is that if things don't work out with Donald, you can vote him out in a few years' time. We're stuck with Brexit.
This is London Calling.
Well, let's get to this week's guest. It's retired astronaut Terry Virts.
This Clash song is, you know, London Calling is perfect, yeah.
What rank are you? I've got you down as commander, but I think you're an Air Force colonel as well.
Yeah, that's it. Commander is a Navy thing, and I kind of hate that, but National Geographic used that on my book because I was the space station commander, but I am a retired Air Force colonel.
I see. Okay. Well, I want to talk to you about your book. I also want to talk to you about some stuff you've written recently that looked to me like you were criticizing NASA's plans for the future. But before we get to any of that, let's get some background about you. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Maryland, in between Baltimore and Washington, in a town called Columbia on the East Coast.
And what kind of a kid were you? Were you interested in space back then? I'm guessing you were.
The first book I ever read was about Apollo in kindergarten. It was one of those, you know, kid reader books about Buzz and Neil landing on the moon.
Uh-huh.
And so I was captivated from a very young age about airplane. I grew up with airplanes and space posters on my wall.
So you weren't old enough to watch Neil's first walk on the moon on TV?
No, I was more like the space shuttle was just coming online when I was, you know, old enough to know what was happening. I was a baby, you know, when Apollo was happening and ending. But really, my conscious life was when we didn't have a space program, and then finally the space shuttle launched. And I can remember watching that as a teenager.
Right. And so you were at school, it was mathematics was your thing, right?
Yeah, I was really a math and science kid, which is funny now because I'm an author and I wrote a book. And the older I've gotten, the more I've realized that communicating is as important, or maybe in some cases more important than the technical things. But when I was younger, I really liked the technical stuff. And it's funny now that I've got a book out and I'm doing speaking. My fourth grade teacher, Mr. Swisher, got in touch with me through Facebook. And he was telling me stories of things he remembered from me, you know. Fourth grade was a long time ago, and I was shocked that he remembered some of the stuff, just the curiosity that I had.
What kind of stuff was he telling you then?
Well, he remembered a field trip we took to Washington, D.C., and I brought a prism with me. And I remember that I had a magnifying glass and stuff, and he told me that I spent 15 minutes explaining to him how a prism worked. And I can totally see my younger self doing that. I was a very curious kid. I got a camera for myself and taught myself how to take pictures with a Konica SLR camera. And I had a telescope. My parents got me a telescope for my birthday, and they bought me an old TRS-80 computer in 1980, I think it was. And this computer didn't have any memory, or there was certainly no hard drive, or it didn't even have a disk drive or anything. So you could turn it on, and then you'd have to write a program yourself if you wanted it to do anything. So I learned how to do BASIC when I was in middle school on my own. I guess I was kind of a curious kid interested in different stuff.
So what was the moment when you decided, you know, you got an interest in space?
Yeah.
But when did you decide, I'm going to be an astronaut?
So my whole life, I wanted to be an astronaut, but that's a crazy desire. I mean, nobody actually gets to do that, right? But I figured out what you needed to do, and being a pilot looked like a good thing, and I wanted to be a pilot anyway, and having a technical degree was important, and which is what I liked anyway. And so I kind of checked all the boxes that you needed to be an astronaut along the way. And there was a moment when I was in Germany as an F-16 pilot, and I was trying to decide, do I want to go to test pilot school to try to be an astronaut, or do I want to try and be on the Thunderbirds, or do I want to go to weapons school, which would be more of an operational F-16 guy? And I just came to this thought. I'm like, you know, being an astronaut is probably not going to happen. It's a crazy dream, but it's my dream, and I need to go for it. Like, I just need, in order to be honest to myself, I need to pursue it. If I don't pursue it, I'll be 80 years old in a rocking chair kicking myself. I should have tried out. So that moment came probably in 1997 when I was an F-16 pilot based in Germany.
And that was it? You just decided you're going to go for it?
I decided I was going to go for the test pilot school track. I applied for test pilot school, ended up at Edwards Air Force Base. And then while we were there, NASA said, we're going to have a new shuttle class of astronauts. And I went ahead and applied while I was still a student. And all my classmates were like, why are you applying now? You don't have enough experience. You should wait, blah, blah, blah. And I said, you're right. I'm not, this other guy's smarter than me. This other guy's better looking than me, but I'm going to go ahead and apply because who knows? And I ended up getting picked. And unfortunately, the classmates who were smarter and better looking than me didn't, because NASA didn't have another class for a long time. They only picked one guy, blah, blah, blah. So the lesson I learned from that was, don't tell yourself no. If there's something, a dream that you have, something you want to do, go for it. And if you don't get it, you can try harder. You can try the next time. You can change your plans. But if you don't even apply for it or try for it or go for it, you'll regret not trying later on. So I guess the lesson that I learned is, don't put yourself down. Sometimes it works out, in my case. And even if it doesn't, at least you tried.
Yeah, and what's the worst thing that can happen is you just get a no. But the important thing is to let someone else say no. Don't you say no. It's a really important lesson.
That's the lesson that I've learned in my career.
That's terrific. So that's a fairly traditional way of becoming an astronaut, from being a jet pilot, a fighter pilot, to a test pilot, to then astronaut, isn't it?
It is. And the last thing I did at NASA when I last year, I was helping them go through the 18,000 applicants that we had to be in the new astronaut class. And there's lots and lots of people that want to be astronauts. And the one thing that everybody needs for NASA anyway is a technical degree, some kind of math or science or medicine or engineering. But there are different paths. You know, the pilot, I think, is a great path, and flying is the best preparation for spaceflight. But we had medical doctors, we had engineers, we had scientists. So there are different career paths that you can take. And the astronaut office is full of people from all of those different career paths, not just pilots.
When you were flying F-16s, did you see any combat?
I flew over Iraq quite a bit, but it was during the 90s.
Yeah.
It was before 2003 war. But yeah, I spent a tour in Korea. Thankfully, no combat there, but, you know, flying up and down the DMZ. And then I did end up doing kind of the no-fly zone work in the 90s.
So what's scarier, flying in an aircraft that could be shot down or flying in a vehicle that's going to space?
Well, if you're rational, of course, going into space is way more, I mean, you're sitting on a rocket with millions of pounds of rocket fuel, so that's way more dangerous. Although, you know, if we had a shooting war against a really advanced adversary, then that would be probably more dangerous too. Thankfully, knock on wood, our space program has had a very good safety records ever since the Columbia accident in 2003. And that's something that we can't let our guard down, because the history is, you know, flying in space, if it goes well for a few years, people forget the accident and everybody thinks it's easy. Well, it's not easy. Like, NASA's doing things, and the Russian Space Agency launching Soyuzes are doing things that are really, really hard. They just do it really well. It looks easy, but that doesn't mean it's easy.
But for you personally, what was the scariest experience? Or is that a redundant kind of thing to say? Do you just not feel fear when you're a fighter pilot or an astronaut?
So as a fighter and pilot and test pilot, I really never felt fear doing those things. I probably should have. It shows that I'm probably not the smartest guy, but I just didn't feel fear doing these things. But I'll tell you, the biggest fear that I had while I was in space was cutting my crewmate's hair. Samantha is an Italian lady,
yeah.
And I flew with her, and she's the most famous Italian woman in the world. And they do these polls, and she's like number one. And so before we went into space, she wouldn't let me fly until I went to her hairdresser with her and learned how to do a proper lady's haircut. And so it's one of the things I never thought I'd do as a fighter pilot, but I learned the whole thing, how to hold the scissors, how to put the clips in. You know, for my hair, I just take the clippers, set it on number two, and you know, my hair is cut. But for hers, it was like this long process. And it was nerve-wracking, because if I screw that up, there's 30 million angry Italian mothers, right? So I didn't want to be that guy.
I think that's be scary for anybody, even on the ground, I think, to cut the hair of the most famous lady in Italy, yeah.
I did it on the ground before. I sat there, and her poor hairdresser for 2.5 hours, talked me through cutting her hair. It was painful, but it worked out pretty good. You can see pictures and videos online. I think she was happy with it, so.
Okay, so you're accepted to be an astronaut with NASA. How long then from being accepted till that first shuttle flight?
It was a long time. For me, it was over 9 years.
Wow.
The guys in my class and the class before me waited between 8 and 12 years for the first flight. So what had happened in the late 90s, NASA just hired way too many astronauts. I think they hired 125 astronauts in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because the space station was being built and they needed all these astronauts. But then they decided not to fly rookies. So they hired all these new astronauts, but they only flew experienced astronauts to do the space station flights because they were, in theory, so complicated and hard to do. And then the Columbia accident happened. The space shuttle Columbia was destroyed, and that really slowed the program down for a few years. And so all these things combined to really make it a long wait for guys in my year group. Nowadays, it's not so bad. It's probably 5 years as an average wait. But, you know, for me, it was almost a decade. It was worth the wait, though. I'm definitely not complaining. And it was interesting while I was waiting, but it was a long wait.
And are you training that whole time?
So, yes, there's always training. We would have simulators, you know, every week or two you go do a shuttle launch practice simulation or an orbital simulation. I worked as a Capcom for a few years where I would go to Mission Control and I would be the person talking to the crew in space on the radio. So we have a team of a flight director and his flight controllers that would run the mission and look at the data and come up with a plan. And me as Capcom, I would be the person that would take that plan and call it up to the guys in space. So I did that. There was a lot of T-38 flying. I did some support. I was like the ground support guy for astronauts on the space station. So I had different technical jobs and assignments. But, you know, there came a point, to be honest, it was probably like at the 8-year point where I was just, okay, this is enough waiting. I'm ready to fly in space. I've been here for a long time.
Yeah.
So waiting for that first space flight definitely required some practice, some patience. I had always been young. I'd always been the first. I'd always been the youngest of everything I'd done. And I got to NASA, and then it was this giant put on the brakes and wait for a decade. And in all honesty, it was a great time. I was able to spend time coaching my kids' sports, which was the best thing I've ever done in my life. And, you know, the time with the kids was great, but it was definitely a wait.
And on that first space shuttle mission, you were the pilot. So that, I mean, does that, I mean, this sounds like a silly question, but does that mean that you fly the space shuttle?
What we call shuttle pilots is commander and pilot. And so the airliner analogy would be captain and co-pilot. So I was kind of like the co-pilot of the shuttle. So I was trained and ready to do everything the commander could do in case he, you know, passed out or couldn't do it. And you could fly as a test pilot. The space shuttle was a dream vehicle because you could manually fly it during launch, during landing in the atmosphere when you were in orbit. And I did, in fact, I did a lot of the rendezvous burns manually while we were docking with the station. When we left the space station, I manually flew the shuttle around. I did a big 360-degree lap around the station. And then once we came back to Earth and we're flying in the atmosphere, I actually took the stick and flew it manually. And then I gave it over to Zambo, the commander, and he actually did the landing. But as a pilot, the space shuttle was an amazing flying machine, and it was really a highlight of my career being able to fly that thing.
Take me through a launch on a space shuttle, then. What's it like?
The space shuttle is like a big muscle car. It's a 4-million-pound vehicle. It puts out 7 million pounds of thrust, and at launch, it burned 23,000 pounds of rocket fuel every second. So when the engines lit off, there was no doubt that something really significant had just happened. The sound of the three main engines on the shuttle itself was this amazing roar that I had never heard before. And then when you actually launch, the two big white solid rocket motors on the side light off. And when those things light off, I was at 4 a.m. at nighttime, and nighttime turned into day. I mean, it just got instantly daytime bright. The amount of roar and shaking and vibrating was just amazing. And you get pushed back in your seat immediately. It's like being in a Formula One race car and just slamming on the gas and getting pushed back in your seat. Except on a rocket in the Formula One race car, and I had a chance to drive a Ferrari, which was amazing. But that only lasts for a couple seconds, and then you're at max speed. On the space shuttle, you get that same acceleration for 8.5 minutes before you're at 17,500 miles an hour. So that acceleration lasts a long time as you're just going faster and faster and faster and climbing out of the atmosphere.
And you've got all that violence of launch, and then suddenly you're completely weightless.
Yeah, the violence of launch, and then like I saw the East Coast of America at nighttime, and I saw the rockets flashing. And we saw the moon. We were pointed right at the moon. There were all these like amazing, surreal experiences. And then back to work, because I'm a shuttle pilot, I got to monitor the engines and do all this other stuff. And then 8.5 minutes later, boom, it's like a light switch happens and everything is weightless and everything is floating. And that is an experience you just don't get on Earth. You can get it in an airplane for a few seconds, but you know, when you go to space, somebody turns on the weightless switch, and it doesn't get turned off until you come back to Earth. And that is amazing. It felt to me like the most powerful force I'd ever felt. Of course, it's not a force, it's weightlessness, but that's what it seemed to be to me. And that definitely there's a learning curve. It definitely takes some time to know how to maneuver yourself and your body, how to keep track of your stuff, how to put your socks on in the morning. It's so entertaining to watch astronauts putting their socks on because they're floating and you're reaching down trying to put them on, and there's all these grown men and women, you know, just like bouncing off the wall, trying to get their pants and their socks on. And but that's part of the fun of being in space.
And how long does it take to adjust to weightlessness then?
So for me, on my first flight, the first couple days, I had a really bad headache. And a lot of people have headaches. A lot of your fluid that's down in your legs, when you don't have gravity, it floats up and there's a lot of pressure in your head. And your vestibular system is all messed up. It doesn't know which way is up or down. And so I was taking a lot of ibuprofen until the morning of day three. And then all of a sudden I felt fine and great. And the rest of the time, I just loved it. On my second flight, my body knew where it was immediately. It was like it had learned weightlessness and boom, it was good. But I was, that's like how you feel. But actually learning to work, to keep track of your stuff, how to float from point A to point B, how to throw tools to your crewmates. You always throw them high because your brain is used to gravity, compensating for gravity.
Yeah.
So that skill, I mean, for me on my 2-week mission, my first mission, I was still getting better. Like I wasn't great by the end of the 2 weeks. But on my 200-day mission, you know, after a few weeks, I had really peaked out and I felt like, man, I can do this. I'm really good. I can get stuff done quickly. I can move from A to B fast. So the learning curve, that was a really interesting kind of self-examination to watch myself learn how to be a spaceman, how to operate in weightlessness. The learning process was fascinating.
And we don't have the shuttle anymore. These days, to get to the International Space Station, it's the Soyuz. You've flown on that too. How do the two experiences, I'm talking about launch here, how do they compare? Launching in a shuttle and launching in a Soyuz, which is basically 1967 technology.
Yeah, it is. I launched from the same launch pad that Yuri Gagarin launched from.
Wow, that would have been cool.
It is really cool. I used to joke with my Russian friends. I'm like, the Air Force has a long history here in Baikonur because, you know, here I am, an Air Force colonel launching into space. And back in 1961, Gary Powers was flying over Baikonur in his U-2. Of course, then he got shot down. But I absolutely love flying with the Russians. I love training there. I really enjoyed the people. I'm still good friends with the cosmonauts I flew. In fact, I just saw Anton, my Soyuz Russian crewmate, yesterday in Houston. He's in Houston this week. So that was a real positive experience for me during all this tension between the West and Russia. Obviously, it's been a bad couple of years, and I flew right in the middle of everything. We imposed sanctions while I was in space, and yet we worked together great. One of the thing I was most proud about as commander was the cooperation I had with my Russian cosmonaut friends and during this political time of tension. But the Soyuz vehicle itself, if the space shuttle is a muscle car, the Soyuz is a little sports car. It's a little MG or, you know, roadster. It is a Russian, it's a Soviet ICBM, basically, that was converted to have a Soyuz capsule instead of a nuclear warhead on top. And when you launch on that thing, it is bam. It's like digital. I mean, you get smashed back in your seat. And you accelerate really quickly. And when the engines shut down, you're violently thrown forward. And it's a digital launch experience. It happens very quick. And there's just no messing around. I mean, like I said, it's a intercontinental nuclear rocket that they put us on top of. And its job is to get going into space quickly. And it does it great. They've launched the Soyuz, I think, over 2,000 times. So they have lots and lots of flight history on that rocket.
And how many Gs do you pull on a Soyuz?
Yeah, the shuttle was limited to 3 Gs, but, you know, there's an airliner strapped to the side of a half-inch thick aluminum tank with 3 struts. And so the shuttle was a little bit less G forces. The Soyuz probably got up to 4 Gs.
Yeah.
Just because it was simpler and beefier structure and smaller. But the G forces were pretty similar because you end up at the same speed and the same, close to the same orbit. So the experiences were similar, but there were definitely some big differences.
And when you pull in the Gs, that's known as eyeballs in, that one, when you're going up, right?
Right. It's like laying on your bed and having three of your best friends lay on top of you. That's kind of the amount of force, right? For 3 Gs,
right,
you weigh 3 times your normal weight. In an F-16, it's a 9G airplane, but that would be like sitting on a chair and having 9 of your best friends sit on your head, right? So the force goes from your head down to your butt, and then it's in a different direction, which is actually a lot worse for the human body because it pulls blood out of your brain.
Right.
And you can pass out. And unfortunately, a lot of people and fighters end up passing out and dying because they're passed out in their airplane. In the rocket, the force is, you know, from your chest to your back. So the blood doesn't get drained out of your brain and you don't have that same G-induced loss of consciousness is what we call it. You don't have that same problem.
And what about the differences in landing? You mentioned landing the shuttle. I mean, it lands like a glider. But the Soyuz is the old-fashioned capsule descent. How's that?
Yeah, the shuttle's 100 pounds. It's an airliner glider. And so very smooth. George Zamka, my commander, did a great landing. The Soyuz is like taking a bowling ball and dropping it out of a first-story window onto the ground. I mean, it is a... it's also another analogy is driving through your neighborhood and just, you know, it's not high speed, but driving in a car and just running into a telephone pole. It was like that level of, that's what it felt like to me. So it's a capsule, it's under a parachute, and it lands on land in the Kazakhstan desert. And it is a big thud. And when we hit, our capsule rolled over 360 degrees. So it was, normally it lands on its side. So the big Russian guy comes in and drags you out and puts you in a chair and, you know, you're good. But when the capsule lands upright, like ours did, we had to crawl out of the capsule ourselves before the big guy could grab you and put you in the chair. So anyway, it was a much, much different landing experience.
What did you learn most from the Russians about space flight?
You know, the Russians have just a different philosophy about everything. Their systems tend to be simpler, more margin. And it's actually a great partnership to have some really complicated but capable American systems and some really simple but basic but reliable Russian systems. The water system always made me laugh because America has this really complicated recycling system that does atmosphere and oxygen and water and even recycles urine. And it's really good because water, everything is $10,000 a pound. And if you can recycle water, you can save a lot of money. But it's also really complicated, and I spent 2 full weeks while I was in space working on the water system. The Russian water system is a tank of water with this pump. You grab the pump, and you pump up some pressure, and then there's a rubber hose, and you push the button, and water comes out. So,
when you say pump it up, what, you actually physically pull a handle?
Like a bike pump, right? You pump
right,
the bike,
yeah.
Air in it. You pump this pump, it puts air in the tank, it pressurizes it. Then you grab the rubber hose and you push a button and water comes squirting out. So it, you know, it's not the complicated recycling system. There's not complicated monitors and sensors and all this stuff. It's just a pump with a hose and you get water. But you know what? It always works. And I didn't have to spend a week of my time maintaining this complicated system. So, and having one of each was really good because we had a simple backup thing that worked. But we had this fancy, complicated system that really did amazing things and allowed us to spend a long time in space without having to constantly launch water. So that's just one analogy of the bigger design philosophy differences between Russia and America. And having them both on the same vehicle was actually, I think, a good combination. It's, you know, in a good marriage, you want the husband and the wife to have, they each bring their own strengths, right? And it's good to have both. Vive la différence. And so that was that was my observation anyway.
And you were commander on the International Space Station. What does that mean? Because you're not actually steering it. It doesn't go anywhere.
That's right. Well, we actually, there are rocket engines and you can maneuver it, but it's a million-pound vehicle. So you talk about how hard it is to turn a battleship. Well, it's really hard to turn a million-pound vehicle going 17,500 miles an hour. Pretty much Isaac Newton's in charge and it's going where it's going. But our Chinese friends blew up a satellite a decade ago with an anti-satellite weapon, and they created this giant cloud of debris at the same altitude and orbit that the space station's in.
Great.
So I actually had to maneuver the station to avoid one of the pieces of debris from that Chinese anti-satellite explosion from 2007. And, usually once or a couple times a year, the station has to maneuver to avoid orbital debris. In general, it's pretty much the flying happens automatically. There's guys on the ground that monitor the attitude and make sure it's upright and whatever. And astronauts in space, whereas on the space shuttle, I spend a lot of my time piloting the vehicle. On the space station, you spend almost none of your time doing that and almost all of your time maintaining equipment or doing science experiments.
What did you learn most about yourself from spending the length of time you spent in space? Because how many days was it? It was a long, long time.
Well, my most recent flight was 200 days.
Yeah. So what did you learn most about yourself spending that amount of time in space?
You know, it's funny. The technical stuff obviously is important to make these vehicles work, but the fuzzy stuff, the interpersonal relationships, how does it impact you? That's really the more important aspect of spaceflight. Those things are more important than technical. And I do speaking for my new career. It's one of the things I'm doing. And one of the lessons learned, or I try and end my talks with a little bit about perspective. And although flying in space didn't change my, you know, religious views or philosophical views or whatever, I'm a Christian, but I hope, took a little bit of the edge off. I'm not as much of a black and white. I'm probably more gray. And the concerns and worries and cares of Earth are usually so silly, and things are rarely as bad as they seem. And so if I get too stressed out on Earth here, I'll try and take myself back to one of these unbelievable, I can't believe I'm seeing this, sunsets, and just realize, hey, that somewhere on Earth right now, that sun is setting. There's been a billion of these sunsets in the past. There'll be a billion more. And there's probably not the reason to be stressed out that I feel. Of course, that's easy to say. It's harder to really not worry. But I guess that's one of the perspectives that I learned from my spaceflight.
More from Terry Virts in a couple of weeks' time, including the emergency he went through on the International Space Station, his tribute to Leonard Nimoy, and everything you need to know about his fabulous new book. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Graham Mac. If you want to hear more Mac Nuggets, check out my website, macmedia.co.uk, and subscribe to my Bob FM show on Apple Podcasts. Got a question or something to say? Send me an email. Put your phone number in the email. I might call you back. I might Skype you on the show. My email address is graham@macmedia.co.uk. And you spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next time. Ta-da.